Welcome to the Consumer Insights Podcast. Every episode, we speak with an insights leader in one of the world's leading brands to hear how they're integrating consumer insights into strategy to move business forward. I'm your host, Thor Olav Filogen. Hello, everyone, and welcome to the Consumer Insights Podcast. So today, I'm excited to be joined by a market and social research strategist, speaker, and writer who, in her own words, puts people first and research second. Annie Pettit is the Chief Research Officer for North America at E2E Research Services. Annie's also the chair of the Canadian ISO Standards Committee. Thank you so much for joining me today, Annie.
You're very welcome. I'm very happy to be here.
Annie, for us to kick off, firstly, maybe could you take a couple of minutes to tell us about yourself, your company, and how you got to where you are today?
Sure. So my background is all in psychology. I originally wanted to do psychometry, which is testing, personality testing, intelligence testing, employment testing, that kind of thing. I did start out doing that. And then I realized, you know, I'm doing the same statistical tests day after day after day. There is more than Cronbach's alpha to doing statistics. And I ended up moving into market research, where we got to do literally everything. Questionnaires, which are just another form of testing, factor analysis, ANOVA, clustering, everything that I had learned in school, all the statistics was suddenly available to me. So I switched right into market research, had a great time, and just over the years have evolved into playing with methodology from a marketing research point of view. And where I am now at E2E Research, we are a full service research provider offering both research companies and clients either full service market research, where we design the questionnaires right all the way through to writing reports and strategizing and recommendations and that sort of thing. And for other clients, they look at us for scripting and hosting. So full range of services, which means I get to understand the full range of where methodology is used in a range of things. So I can have impacts on writing better questionnaires, writing better reports, doing better analyses, all sorts of things. So lots of great things to do with EDE research.
Thank you for sharing that. And Annie, I had the privilege of meeting you, and we talked about this before we got started, pre-COVID. We met pre-COVID. I think, you know, obviously you've spent a lot of time in this industry and worked from, you know, you have such deep experience that I would really like to start off with what might sound like a very simple question, but that actually hides an iceberg, which is, how do you define an insight?
Okay. Yeah, I've heard lots of different people describe what they feel an insight is. I think most of us agree on what it is not. When you get an Excel file and it's got 300 worksheets and it's just reams and reams and reams of tables, this is just data. There's nothing insightful about a set of data, set of numbers and a report. You know, when you open your PowerPoint report and you see 66% of people said this, did this, there's nothing insightful there. The insightful part comes, and from my perspective, when that light bulb goes off. So perhaps there is a number on the page, 66% of people did this. If it's something that everybody knows, we've seen before, this is kind of normal stuff, that's not insight, that's just data. But when you're reading that and it's like, oh my God, I never thought of that before. It may be basic, maybe simple, but if that light bulb just turned on in your brain, that's an insight. And I expect that for any project we do, we're lucky to find one real insight. a real genuine light bulb that has just never occurred to you before. Throughout a report, there's probably 3 or 4 or 5 kind of neat things. I hadn't thought about it in that way. That seems a little surprising, but just one true, that just changed how I think about everything, completely brand new to me. So that's how I see an insight, those light bulbs.
I really like that definition, Annie, because it really forces you to ask yourself, did that really alter the way I see things? Was this something, was this a data point that kind of was what I would expect? Or was it a data point that was, you know, partially interesting and maybe, you know, brought something new to the table? Or was it a light bulb moment? Because that's, the, you know, obviously that is not something that you will come across on a regular basis easily. It actually is quite tricky to get to one of those. Now, I think what's interesting with you is you have this background in psychology, right? And I think what market research allowed you to do is to allow you to use the full breadth of your knowledge and apply that in making analysis. But for people that are not necessarily as seasoned in the industry, can't you tell us why are marketing consumer insights so important? And what does analyzing and integrating research allow businesses to do?
Sure. I'll make one comment about psychology. This is one of those cases where a lot of people come out from school with their degree in psychology and like, I'm qualified for nothing. I can't do anything with a psychology degree. And I just, my mind is blown every time. It's like, do you want me to list out all the things that you are now uniquely qualified for with the psychology degree? And market research is like right in front. If you want to use a psychology degree, this is the place to go. It's incredibly right on par for what you need to learn, how you need to be skilled. So that aside, why is research important? I look at it like this. Every single person has unique insight into the world. I see things from my perspective, from how I was raised with my siblings, with my parents, in my cities, at my school, my first jobs, all the things that I did. That's my unique perspective. But from your point of view, it's 100% different. Where you lived, your parents, your school, that's all completely different. Like I could even look at my immediate sibling, same gender, same school, same parents, same city, 100% completely different perspective. We think we can see how other people are thinking and feeling because you know, we're pretty close to a situation. Absolutely cannot. We are all biased in some specific way. It's the same for any brand manager. As a brand manager, you are intrinsically close to your brand. You have seen everything, how it was built, how it evolved, how it was conceptualized. You know that brand inside and out. But you don't know my perspective on the brand, my sibling's perspective on the brand, your perspective. Everyone has a completely different perspective on the brand. So this is why we desperately need insights to help us figure out what perspectives are about a brand. We really need to know what other people think, not just what I think, because my view of what is important or what is true about a brand, absolutely not the same as what you think is important or true about a brand.
I think that's really, really spot on, right? Because it is true that we do think that we can see things from, you know, we have enough to understand from the customer's perspective, but in reality, we are very much limited by our biases, right? And I think that's true for anyone that you work with and that's on, you know, a brand manager at a company that is, of course, very well versed in all the details of the brand, right? Which is, that's what they're paid to do, right? So fully agree. But I'm also thinking about the application of, you know, insights and consumer insights. And could you maybe, talking about the application and, you know, again, kind of leveraging your experience, tell us a bit about someone, it doesn't have to be someone you work with, but case where you've actually highlighted that power of research, you know, maybe a business example where it has been integrated, an insight has been integrated in an interesting way. For instance, you know, to build in a, like a better campaign or a project, or just like an example where that has been applied in a very powerful way?
Sure. I'll mention two, one very briefly, and then one I love the details about it. So one thing we've heard for years, decades, I'm not sure how long we've heard this. Steve Jobs never does market research. Every time I would hear that, it just drove me nuts. It's 100% not the case. Let's say maybe he didn't do questionnaires. Maybe he didn't do focus groups. But market research is vastly more than questionnaires and focus groups. They have reams of transactional databases. All the analytical work around the purchase data, website data, all of that stuff, that's market research. So yes, he was doing market research all along to build his business into what it is. Competitive analysis, they were always doing that too. They were always paying attention to incoming emails and complaints. This is market research. So for a brand that did no market research, they did reams of it. Just not what we traditionally like to call it. So we really need to open our minds to what is market research. And it goes far beyond questionnaires and groups.
And then I'm just going to add something here, because I spoke to Edwin Taborda on our previous episode, who's at Electrolux, and he even went as far as saying that Steve Jobs was an insights person. You know, the Steve Jobs was really, and I think that's super powerful, right? Because I remember kind of being taken by surprise, but that of course he was, right? I mean, he was definitely utilizing that, and that's what's made him so successful. He was actually being able to build that deep understanding and allow that to shape everything he did with Apple and with the products that they launched. But yeah, I didn't mean to interrupt you, cut your flow. That was the first part.
Yeah. It's cool to say I don't need market research, but you're all doing it whether you think you are or not. So the second example I'll mention is a brand that we probably all know and many of us probably love a lot, which is Lego. That company's been around for nearly 100 years. They make, you know, those tiny little plastic bricks that you can build into whatever you may wish to build it in. So as a kid, my brother, he loved making cars and spaceships. Day after day after day was a new car, a new spaceship, more of this stuff. My partner, the same, spaceships, castles. The Lego toy was loved by boys in so many places around the world. However, it was barely less than 20 years ago. Lego was trying to increase their profits to compete with companies like Mattel, and they just about went bankrupt. They tried making action figures and other toys, did not work, nearly lost the company. So what did they do instead of just innovating? Clearly just innovating, making new stuff was not working. So they ended up turning to research. They ended up doing things like MRI scans of kids. What were their brains doing while the kids were playing? So they realized that kids just love skill-based play. They love the challenge of building something. So this insight led to them making toys of varying complexities. So the younger kids had a toy that was suited for the complexity they required. The older kids had complexity for what they required. And the adults had enormous sets with thousands of pieces and cost hundreds of dollars. They're like Colosseum, the Millennium Falcon, the Taj Mahal. So now they figured out a way to get adults interested in paying like $1,000, $800 for a children's toy for themselves. So that was the first insight they came up with through research. Complexity suited for the audience. Then the second part that I love has to do with gender. Gender on its own is a whole huge issue. We socialized kids to have a gender in the way that we believe a gender should be. So let's just put that aside and accept that we have socialized a male gender and a female gender and have expectations for what those should be. So what Lego realized is only a very small percentage of girls were playing with Lego toys. Even though there's nothing even remotely genderized about the toy, it is just pieces of plastic. So they did their research and they tried to figure out what did girls want from the toys. So instead of just assuming what girls want, let's not just innovate something. Let's actually do the research and figure out what do girls want. So at that time, they realized the girls loved the vibrant colors. So that's where we see now the pink and purple and bright blue, bright green, bright yellow, all the great colors, far more than just black, gray, and yellow. Boring. And they also tried to make sure that the things that could be built were things that were of the female stereotype. So while my brother was making cars and spaceships, I was making houses and parks and gardens. So this like bango hit onto what I was doing as a girl. So they introduced the Friends Lego line, specifically made for girls, colorful, had lots of things to make houses, things to make gardens, lots of cute little animals. So now when gift giving season arrives, my partner gets the nice Star Wars sets and I get the Friends sets, and we're both really happy because the research gave us the Lego that we actually wanted, even as adults.
That's a fascinating story. I mean, I know Lego very well, but I did not know that how much it had impacted the trajectory of that company, because you're right. I mean, I remember it being at the brink of bankruptcy and they were actually able to do, I mean, now it's incredible what they've been able to do since. But I think it's also interesting on a personal level. I mean, I have two daughters and, you know, and they, both of them are really into the Friends set. And even though if I tried to build a spaceship every now and then, they're really not interested. I think it is true, right? I mean, kids love the challenge in building something, but we all do, like as an entrepreneur. I mean, I love building something too, but it's just like a different, the age on the box set is different, right? So I think that's a very good point. I think it would be interesting to get your viewpoint, having interacted with, been in the industry for so long and kind of interacted with clients over all these years. What is it? How would you think, like, because now we've talked about the benefits, right? We've talked about what Lego was able to do. And I think we both have a viewpoint on Apple that is clear. I think we at least share the same view here, but what's the consequence? What's the probable consequence of not conducting market research? What will happen then?
Oh, goodness gracious. I would say the one big advantage of conducting market research is not to necessarily create success, find success, but to increase your chances of finding success. So you can just go ahead and innovate and make stuff, but that doesn't mean you will be successful. Some people will, and we know, I can't remember what the actual statistic is, whatever, 5% of brand new companies are successful. But without market research, you're going to be among that 5% chance. By conducting research, you will increase that chance of success. You'll have a much greater chance of understanding what the potential drawbacks, weaknesses, worry points are of your business, and be able to work around them, avoid them. With research, you'll have a better idea of what your competitors are doing, trying to do, hoping to do. Same thing, you'll be able to either work around that or understand how you are doing better than that. So I think it really is important to respect what market research offers, to take full advantage of it whenever you have the opportunity to do so. I think I talked around your question, but
I think that was a clear perspective. And I think you might also, advising other companies and guiding them, you know, in your job over these years, you must have seen a lot of mistakes also. And what is, if you were to highlight one, what is the one mistake you see a lot of businesses making when it comes to conducting market research?
Sure. So I'll call this one a pet peeve, I think, stat testing. Which is very funny, because in school, I took every single statistics class I could, every psychometrics measurement design class I could. For me, that was the funnest part, if funnest is a word. But now I've completely reversed trends on that. I 100% appreciate the need for statistics. You need to do segmentation. You need to do ANOVAs. You need to do the stats. But at the end of the day, we sit there and we look at the p-value, like, oh, it's 0.06. Well, this was a waste of my time. Or it's 0.04. I knew we had something important here. That p-value, I find, is the most useless. I'm going to get in trouble for this. Most useless number out there. I don't care what the p-value is. I can manipulate that p-value into anything I want just by changing my sample size. It's a pointless number. We really need to spend more time looking at effect sizes. So if 30% of people buy this versus 30%, 32% of people buy that, is 30 versus 32 meaningful? I don't care if that's significant or not. I don't care. Would I change my business based on 30 versus 32? That's what matters. So I am at a point where I pretty much never do p-value tests anymore. Statistics, yes, I do that all the time. P-values are pointless. If you're looking at a set of data and your brain says, I wonder if that's statistically significant, then don't waste your time. If you have to wonder whether it's statistically significant, it's not important enough to pay attention to. Press on. Move to where the numbers go, holy cow, I cannot believe this is 30 and this is 38. It's the same sort of thing. I don't care if that statistically, if that p-value is 0.04 or not, if that 30 versus 38 makes me pause, that is far more important. That's when I'm going to pay attention.
No, I really like that. So it's really, I mean, all it's almost like the test is, you know, do you need to force it? I mean, if you're thinking about the statistical significance, yeah, that's kind of a warning sign, right? That's not the right question you should be asking yourself here. I'm with you 100%. And tell me, but there are a lot of different types of methodologies, right? So when you conduct market research, and how the differences in these methodologies, how will they shape the role of market research companies in the future, in your view?
Oh, goodness. I feel like the analytical space, the analytical tools that we have, are going to have a huge impact really on our work. Historically, we really only had questionnaires and focus groups. There was no other way to get information. But now, the digital space, oh my goodness, every single thing we do everywhere is recorded. Anytime you look at a website, think about what you want to buy. They're not just recording what you added to the basket, the SKU, the size, the coupon. That's not all they're doing. They're watching your mouse. The mouse went to this part of the page. It went to this part of the page. It dismissed this part. All of that is getting stored somewhere. So the folks who have background in statistics, background in SQL and SAS, R, Python, whatever it is, those analytical people, I think they are going to see the expansion of our industry hugely. So much market research is going to move from our traditional tools into those analytical tools. The way I see it is behavior is the best data you can have. We all know the bias. People will say anything, but it really only comes down to what will they do? Like, oh, sure, yeah, I would buy that. Have you ever bought it?
No.
It sounds so obvious when you say it, you know, but oh my God.
Yeah. So I really think we're going to see analytical tools really take over the market research space in the future.
I think that's something we should bring with us, right? This the fact that these analytical tools will play a bigger and bigger role going into the future. And again, guiding people, so guiding our listeners, what opportunities do you think that there are for insights professionals? You know, with your perspective on the future, how can they make a true business impact? And how can they, what many people want to do, challenge the status quo?
Right. Right. One of the things I would love to see people do in terms of challenging the status quo is, it comes down to basic things. Look at the research you're doing right now. Look at the designs you're doing right now. And truly ask yourself, why am I doing it like this? So for many of us, we have a favorite research design. I will confess I have two: questionnaires and analytics. So whenever I start to ponder a research study, questionnaires it is. I have that as a template, and then I have two favorite sample sizes, and it's 300 and it's 700. Question that. So when it comes to that 300, why 300? Well, we choose 300 because it's cheaper, which is a terrible answer. We know that when we choose 300, it's basically impossible to learn anything about marginalized groups of people. We can't learn anything about Black, Indigenous people, even though in the U.S. there's something like 40 million Black people. But in a typical study of 300, we're lucky to get 30 Black people. So then, you know, they just get averaged in and dismissed because, well, we couldn't figure out anything about Black people. So, you know, they're just a small group of people in the study, so don't pay attention. And Indigenous people, that's an even smaller group, so we can't do anything with that. But they are millions of people, and our status quo has been just average it into the rest of people. That's not a good status quo to keep, and something I would love for us to actively change. Not just, well, let's get 5 or 10 more people, but I mean massively oversample marginalized people so that we can actually understand who they are, what they need, what they want, instead of just averaging them in overall. The same thing with any technique we are doing. If you instantly have an answer for here's how I do it, question yourself, why? Why can't I do it differently? How can I do it differently? What am I missing by just doing it the same way every time? It's difficult. It makes your research take longer, but truly it is better in the long run. Absolutely.
And tell me, Anya, I think that's really good advice. But on the flip side, if you think about challenges, what type of challenges do you think that Insights professionals, but also the wider industry, should expect in the near future?
Sure. One of the challenges, we've really seen this in the last couple of years, and it always disappoints me, is the lack of numeracy, the lack of understanding of research and science in the broader population. Many, many people don't understand how science works. They don't understand that data changes, new data arises, conclusions change. They feel like they're being manipulated or somehow they're not getting the full truth. There's just not sufficient understanding of science means change. As we learn, we change. And we've seen this with in the polling area as well. Outsiders looking in, they see us doing waiting. Why are you waiting, marginalized people? Why are you making Black people count for more? We're not making any person count for more, but we're making sure the data are accurate. There's just not a lot of understanding about sampling and waiting. So it makes our industry look bad. There are many things that the general population just doesn't really understand about market research. And I think we need to do a better job of helping people understand why am I excluded from research, or why am I screened out of research? There are many places along the research journey where we can help people learn, here's why you were screened out, because other people who kind of look like you have already participated. Simple little things we can do to help. So I think if we can do a better job of educating the public about why we do what we do and how our processes work, I think our industry will work out better in the long run.
That's interesting. And I think it's in some odd way, you can almost tie it to the difficulties we have when we step into this. I mean, the sense that we assume that, you know, we understand the consumer. And at the same time, we kind of assume that they understand us, right? But they don't.
Right.
So it's, you know, it's the others. It's the, yeah, it's effectively, you know, the other side of the coin. But I think that's a very good point. Hey, Annie, I think although I really have enjoyed this conversation, we are approaching the end, but I have one last question for you. So the world of insight is a big one, but if you had to pick one person, who in the world of insights would you love to have lunch with?
Okay, there are several people I would love to have lunch with, but I am going to name one, a person I'm a huge fan of, Whitney Dunlop Fowler. She is the founder of Insights into Color, and I just love the work she does. She's so focused on making sure that marginalized people get their place in the market research space, whether that's us understanding them as consumers, customers, clients, however that may be, or from the researcher perspective, making sure that those researchers have more face time in the research world. So definitely it would be Whitney that I'm going to have lunch with.
I would love to join you for that lunch. It seems like it's a person that I think I probably could learn a great deal from also. Annie, this has been such a great and insightful conversation. It's always fantastic to hear from you, somebody that's so passionate. And I at least have remembered a lot of things from this conversation. If I'm just going to play back a couple, I think it's advice for us as insights professionals is to really force ourselves to question our own preferred choices in terms of methodology and really challenge the way we approach things. Sure, it has always worked for us, but that's actually a good reason for us to question that. But I also think you reminded me of something that is very easy to forget, right? Because, and that's something that behavior is always the best data that we have. You know, it's like no matter what people tell you they will do, what are they actually doing? I think that's a very, very good thing to be reminded of. I know that I've learned a lot from talking to you today, and I'm sure our audience has as well. So thank you, thank you, thank you for joining me today. And thanks everyone for listening in.
You're very welcome. I'm glad to join you.
Consumer Insights Podcast is brought to you by Strivito, the user-friendly enterprise insights platform. To find out more about Strivito, visit strivito.com and make sure to search for Consumer Insights in Apple, Google, Spotify, or anywhere else podcasts are found. Click follow so you don't miss any future episodes. On behalf of the team here at Strivito, thank you for listening.